Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another APS Portfolio Strategy Conference call. This is Housing Present, Future, and its Impact on Markets, and I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy at Amherst Pierpont. For those of you who tried to join us last week on the first version of this call when our call system crashed, thank you for making the return trip. I'm pretty sure it's the first time a conference call on housing broke the internet. So if Beyonce's agent is listening, call me. So housing suddenly has become a surprise part of the story of today's high inflation and the Fed's response to it. It is probably the most visible part of the economy showing the impact so far of the Fed's inflation fight. Mortgage rates this year have doubled. Home sales are down. Home prices are also starting to slip. But as you will hear today, the prospects for housing may look bearish for now, but they unfold against a market that is really chronically short on housing supply. And, of course, all of this has market implications. It's shaping prepayment and credit risk in MBS, the multifamily and single-family rental markets, and parts of investment-grade credit. Luckily, we have an extraordinary set of experts here today to help us figure this all out. Stephen Stanley, Chief Economist here at APS. Laurie Goodman, a nationally known expert on housing and mortgage finance. And Brian Landy, Mary Beth Fisher, and Dan Brizzo, all senior strategists here at APS. We're aiming for about 40 minutes of thoughts from our speakers, and then an open Q&A from our listeners. One administrative detail, if you look on the right side of your webinar screen, and just to be clear, there's a call-in number and a link to seeing the webinar, you should see a chat box where you can post your questions. So please post questions at any time. We are going to wait until the end of our speakers' remarks to start fielding those. So let's jump right in with a view of housing from our chief economist, Stephen Stanley. Stephen, take it away.
Good morning, or good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for dialing in. Let me start by talking a little bit about housing in the context of the overall economy. Housing is a small piece of GDP. It's only about 3.4%, but as we all know, it does have pretty important ripple effects. When people buy homes, they generally buy things to fill them up. Just as an example, two of the weakest categories in retail sales over the past several months, not surprisingly, have been furniture stores and electronics and appliance outlets. So that is a good example of the sort of ripple effects that housing has. Similarly, on the employment front, construction accounts for about 7.7 million jobs in the economy, which is about 5% of total payroll employment. But, housing, the residential piece of that is only about half of that total, so call it 2.5% of total employment. So not a huge piece of the economy, strictly speaking, but a very important part, and one that I think, most people would argue kind of leads things, particularly in terms of the impacts of Fed rate hikes. One place where housing hits beyond its weight, I would argue, is inflation. As you know, for most households, shelter costs are the largest single expense, and that is certainly reflected in the inflation numbers. In the CPI, shelter costs represent about 30% of overall CPI and 40% of the core. So it's going to be pretty hard for the Fed to get inflation down unless or until they get a handle on shelter costs. And some research that I've written on elsewhere from the Dallas Fed notes that shelter costs tend to lag home prices by about 12 to 18 months. And so we know that, as Steve mentioned, that home prices seem to be turning down or at least flattening out over the last few months, but that means that that the shelter costs piece of the inflation indices is likely to be continuing to accelerate well into 2023. Turning to the near-term outlook for the housing sector, I would say that the weakness we've seen this year is really an affordability issue. and in particular, the two things that drive affordability within the housing market, home prices and mortgage rates. And home prices have surged over the last couple of years since the early days of the pandemic. And mortgage rates have shot up this year in response to the Fed activity. Basically, 30-year mortgage rate has doubled. It was around 3% at the turn of the year, and it's now well over 6%. So the result of that, the National Association of Realtors puts out a an affordability index, which incorporates those things as well as income trends. And you can see in the first chart there that affordability has deteriorated sharply. And not surprisingly, home sales have followed, and certainly, you know, this chart would suggest at least that we probably have some distance still to go in terms of the downward adjustment to home prices, given how steeply affordability has deteriorated. The good news here is that this affordability issue should be self-correcting over time. As housing demand weakens, home price appreciation should moderate. We're already seeing signs of that. If the overall economy cools, presumably mortgage rates would be expected to drop. So, you know, this is really a cyclical issue, and as we know, cycles by their nature come and go. But I also want to spend some time focusing on the longer-term horizon, the secular forces that really drive the housing market over long periods of time. And these, you know, in this perspective, we're really focused on things that are driving supply and demand of housing over a long period of time. On the demand side, it would be things like population growth and household formation. On the supply side, things like the cost and availability of land and materials and skilled construction labor. And, of course, later in the call, Laurie's going to talk quite a bit about this these issues as well. But I would just note that coming into the pandemic, the housing market was generally considered tight, undersupplied, home prices were firm, inventories were relatively low. And interestingly enough, something that, you know, the shoe that hadn't really fully dropped before the pandemic but had been talked about for years was a big influx of first-time home buyers. A lot of this these long-term trends are driven by demographics, and the children of baby boomers, representing very large age cohorts, had entered the traditional age when people start to buy their first homes in the 20-teens, but we weren't seeing it come through the housing data. And you know, it looks like in retrospect that this generation got married at a later age, had kids at a later age, and as a result, reasonably, started buying homes at a later age. And so that was just starting to show itself a little bit in the year or two before the pandemic. But then the pandemic fundamentally altered the course of the housing sector. And, you know, we all know some of the adjustments that were made. Many families moved from urban apartments to larger homes in the suburbs or even in rural areas. This is a move that has been certainly you know, underpinned by the move toward working from home, remote work. That's a, you know, moving from an apartment to a larger home is a one-for-one trade in terms of the quantity of housing units, but it may still be give us a bit of an increase in the aggregate dollar value, because of course a single-family home on average is more expensive to build than a one unit of an apartment building. But more importantly, from a broad standpoint, people were looking for their own place in response to the pandemic. A lot of the doubling and tripling up that had been common in the last decade seemed to unwind. You had multiple generations of families living together. You know, the iconic young adult living in their parents' basement. Maybe groups of young friends cramming five or six people into a three-bedroom apartment. Those sorts of things lost their appeal with the pandemic and the urge to kind of spread out and get away from people to some degree. So as a result, we saw a massive spike in household formation in 2020, as you can see in the next display. And, you know, housing starts and household formation should be linked over time. The one complication in there is that, of course, some piece of the housing stock is done away with every year, you know, maybe destroyed by natural disasters or torn down or just simply replaced. And therefore, you know, that usually represents about 250,000 a year in units that are permanently taken out of the housing stock. And so housing starts should probably exceed household formation over time by about that amount. And, you know, as you can see in the chart, 2020 was a period that you were already seeing household formation that was exceeding housing starts in the years prior to the pandemic, but then you had this massive spike in household formation in 2020, which led to a big imbalance. If I run those data back about 20 years and look at the cumulative increases in the two series, it looked like the supply of housing was maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of a million units short as of the end of 2019. But when household formation, which had been averaging between 1.3 and 1.4 million per year, spiked to 3 million in 2020, that results in demand, an extra 1.7 million units worth of housing demand, which is more than a full year's worth of housing starts. Housing starts did increase in 2020, and they increased again in 2021. And some of those increases in, you know, some of those movements in household formation have been reversed, which makes sense. Some of what happened was kind of temporary. Maybe people moved to a second home during COVID, and then now they're back to where they started. So household formation has been running a little shy of that pre-COVID trend, but the excess has been only about half of it has been closed. So demand is still about a million units ahead of where it might have been if the pandemic hadn't occurred. And while housing starts have picked up, again, we're still running pretty far behind. It looks like the housing market was maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2.5 million units undersupplied as of mid-2022. And, of course, that will be overwhelmed in the very short term by the cyclical movements. But over time, you know, that suggests to me that the housing market is likely to get back to a firm footing once the cycle has run its course. Let me just finish by talking for 1 minute about home prices. Of course, home prices soared in the 2 years of the pandemic. You know, there's the next exhibit is comparison of home prices and GDP. And, you know, tried to be as fair as I could with the scaling, and you know, we could play all sorts of games with the scaling, but I think this is probably about the best way to scale the two series. And what it suggests is that home prices were somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10% too high relative to nominal GDP as of early 2022. So that, you know, that market will clear either sooner or later. It could clear sooner if we have a drop in home prices, or it could clear a little bit later if home prices kind of run steady while nominal GDP continues to grow. In any case, you know, I think the good news here is that it feels like it should be a relatively limited adjustment, certainly compared to what we saw in 2008. And the final thing I would note is that unlike the housing crisis, when there was a tremendous amount of leverage, both in terms of what homeowners themselves had as well as the leverage in the financial system, we don't see that this time. Homeowners' equity as a percentage of real estate value as of the middle of 2022 was at basically at its highest levels since the early 1960s. So I think in many ways, while we're seeing a pretty nasty cyclical correction in housing, that the underlying fundamentals look pretty good when you think of it in a longer term perspective. And with that, I will hand it back to Steve.
All right, thanks very much, Stephen. So few people have really spent as much time with housing and mortgage finance over the years as Laurie Goodman, and she invariably brings a very detailed view of the issues. So today it's a detailed view of exactly the topic that Stephen was talking about before, the factors that have kept the supply of U.S. housing from keeping up with demand. So let me turn it over to Laurie. Laurie, take it away.
Well, thank you very much. It's really nice to be on with you today. I appreciate the invite. Can you cue my slides, please? I'm going to be talking about causes and solutions of a chronic housing supply shortfall. Next slide. I'm going to make the following points. house supply is well short of demand, amplifying Steve's point. Second, while barriers in the multifamily market have received a lot of attention from policymakers, single-family barriers have not. 77% of the housing stock that is single-family, that is 1 to 4 family, 18% is multifamily, and 5% is manufactured housing. The drivers of the housing supply shortage include restrictive zoning, restrictive building codes, high construction costs, including labor and materials, and financing constraints. On the single-family side, there are a number of affordable options that, if the barriers to them were mitigated or partly mitigated, would be a lot more popular. Manufactured housing, increased ADU, that is accessory dwelling unit production, home preservation, and modular and panelized construction. While there are many obstacles to increasing the supply in these sectors, financing impediments are the only one that could be resolved at the federal level. And finally, the slowing of household growth could eventually rescue us, but it's going to take decades. Next slide, please. There's no question that supply is well short of demand. We can debate how short. Freddie Mac in 2021 estimated a shortage of 3.8 million units. The National Association of Realtors pointed out that we're 5.5 million fewer units were built from 2001 to 2020 versus the three-decade prior per annum average. Steven just pointed out we have a shortfall of at least 1 million units, possibly more, and Jim Parrott and Mark Sandy say we're 1.7 million units short. We are definitely short. The bottom picture on this slide shows the population-adjusted housing production. It's with approximately 7.8 units were built per 1,000 population for the 48 years from 1959 to 2006. In 2021, that number was 5.1 units per 1,000 population. Single-family starts are lower than they were in the 1990s and 2000s. By contrast, multifamily starts are the highest they've been since the 1986 Tax Act. Next slide. There's no question that the housing stock in the United States is aging, and this will be a further drag on supply. There are about 140 million housing units in the United States. The median home was built in 1978. It turns 44 this year. If the obsolescence rate is 0.33%, that knocks out 462,000 units. If the obsolescence rate is 0.4%, that is less than a half of 1%, that knocks out 560,000 units in a world in which we completed 1.34 million units in 2021. So obsolescence is going to become an increasingly important issue in the years ahead. So when you think about supply, well, historically it may have only knocked out about 250,000 units. You have to assume that number is going to grow in the years ahead. Now let me move on, next slide please, to talk about some of the obstacles, the drivers of the supply shortage. Certainly, next slide, yeah, good. Certainly zoning is very important. This shows you that land share has become a much more important part of property value on the left-hand side of the slide. The right-hand side of the slide shows that land values have way outpaced values of the structure. So land prices have gone up way more than the prices of building. One solution to this is to build more intensively, that is to make better use of the land. Accessory dwelling units, which are second units on the same grounds as a single family home, that is, it could be a backyard cottage, it could be a basement apartment, it could be a garage conversion, are one very promising route because they're sort of politically acceptable, higher density. For a long time, accessory dwelling units were either not allowed or sort of are allowed, but, well, the lot coverage restrictions still apply, the minimum lot size restrictions still apply, the setbacks apply, the parking restrictions apply, so essentially they were prohibited. In the last couple of years, two states, Oregon and California, and a number of cities, including Seattle, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Austin, Texas, have basically allowed for ADUs as a matter of right. That is, they've removed the restrictions on lot coverage, minimum lot size, minimal setbacks, and parking restrictions have been removed. And I think this is very, very promising that other cities may follow suit. Next slide, please. Another area where zoning has had a major impact is manufactured housing. Manufactured housing is the single most affordable housing that is out there. You can see on average it costs about $72 per square foot to produce without the land versus site-built housing of $144 per square foot. Next slide, please. When you look at what's happened to manufactured housing from 1977 to 1994, we shipped about 240,000 units of manufactured housing each year. For the last 5 years, it's been about 100,000 units. Much of this reflects the fact that there's been almost no new manufactured housing communities built since the year 2000 because of zoning restrictions. Indeed, more intensive land use is clearly part of allowing for more affordable housing, and hopefully that will happen. Next slide, please. Now I'd like to move on to talk about regulatory costs, particularly building codes. The National Association of Home Builders has showed that regulatory costs are about 24% of the cost of a home. About 10.5% of that is regulation during lot development, and about 13.3% of that is regulation during construction of the structures. There are two lines of this that I want to highlight. Changes due to building codes over the past 10 years are 6.1% of the total. Architectural design standards beyond the ordinary are another 2.7%. These two factors are 8.9% of total construction costs. We can't keep adding to building costs without looking at what type of benefits they bring. Next slide, please. Another obstacle which is prohibiting supply is the high cost of labor and materials. There's not much you can do about the cost of materials, but labor construction, there's certainly some options. This slide just shows you construction job openings are near historic highs. A lot of workers left the industry in 2008. In addition, the construction industry has a very large proportion of foreign-born workers. Apparently, about 32% of the industry is foreign-born versus 17% for the nation as a whole. There are ways to cut labor costs. You can use more efficient construction methodology. This means manufactured homes. This means modular, panelized, and pre-cut homes. They're not reliant on the weather. The factories can operate 24/7. Manufactured homes are built to federal standards. Modular, panelized, and pre-cut homes are built to state and local standards, which makes them much less scalable. Next slide, please. You can see how low the use of modular, panelized, and pre-cut home construction is. It's about 3% of total U.S. production. So, indeed, allowing for modular, panelized, and pre-cut homes to be built to federal codes would make a big difference. Next slide, please. I'm going to move on to talk about financing, and I want you to remember this slide. About 39%, the denial rate on renovation financing is very high, about 39% versus 13% for home purchase and refinancing loans. Next slide, please. Finally, when we talk about construction, about barriers to supply, financing constraints are extremely major. Acquisition, development, and construction lending is very tight, and this is especially detrimental to smaller builders with no financing alternatives. These builders tend to build more affordable homes. Regulatory obstacles, that is, the regulators come down very hard on AD&C loans. Regulators should reevaluate the risk of this lending. The manufactured housing arena. If you own your own land and you take out a real estate loan, you get terms not that dissimilar to what you get on site-built homes. However, if you don't own your own land, or because you're in a manufactured home community, because you've rented the land, or because the home is on family land that you don't want to encumber, you are in a world of chattel or personal property loans. There's effectively no federal lending for these loans. The FHA Title I program could be improved and these loans should be deliverable into Ginnie 2 securities on a de minimis basis. Accessory dwelling unit construction and property preservation both rely on renovation financing, which is very, very cumbersome and has a high denial rate. On FHA construction loans that you have to hire a consultant. On GSE loans for major construction, the GSEs have recourse to the lender during the construction period. While fixes to this are possible, a simplified preferred vendor system would make more sense, where Fannie Mae selects, say, Home Depot as their preferred lender. Home Depot comes in and says, well, this is the type of renovations you can justify in terms of adding to property value. Here's what it'll cost, and then Fannie makes the loan on that basis. And then finally, accessory dwelling unit financing just does not take into account the rental income the accessory dwelling unit will generate. This is really important. Obviously, if I put an accessory dwelling unit on my home, I could use it for home study. I could rent it out. I just could let my mother-in-law live there. So maybe you shouldn't count the full amount of the rental income, but counting zero seems too extreme. Skip ahead two slides, please. So in conclusion, Stephen Stanley pointed out that we have an acute housing supply shortage, and the recent surge in demand has increased prices. The housing supply shortage is particularly acute for affordable supply. Population growth is certainly slowing, but it's going to take us decades to grow our way out of this supply shortage. There are opportunities for builders and lenders to step in and solve the number one housing issue, which is the lack of supply. Thank you very much for including me today.
All right. Thanks very much, Laurie. I'd add to your conclusion that not only can builders apparently do something, but it's interesting the lack of financing in ADUs and manufactured housing may be an opportunity for lenders and investors as well. So we move on at this point from some of the fundamentals of housing and start to look at some of the market implications. And both the long and the short cycles in housing affect residential MBS. They do that through their influence on prepayments and obviously credit. And at this point, the MBS market has probably never been more sensitive to housing than it is today. And Brian Landy has those details. Brian.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. And I appreciate you taking the time to call in and listen. Yeah, housing is more important than ever when thinking about the value of mortgage-backed securities, with most of the MBS market trading well below par. So the first slide shows that the average agency MBS pool is now priced slightly above $85. And that's by far the lowest level in at least the last 20 years, and probably quite a bit longer than that. So when dollar prices are low, small differences in prepayment speeds can have a large effect on value. A small absolute change is a large percentage change. So a half CPR difference in speeds that would have had a small effect on prices during a refinance environment is quite important now. And the biggest contributor to discount prepayments is housing turnover, people moving. Things like home equity, geography, loan size, and seasoning are going to be important contributors to the relative value of mortgage-backed securities from that. And equity extraction using cash-out refinances is another possible source of prepayments and is critically dependent on housing and home prices. So people move for a variety of reasons. There's job changes and losses, income growth and reduction, marriage and divorce, having kids, downsizing after the kids hopefully move out, and so on. People also move because they can afford a nicer home. And over the last few years, the shift to working from home pushed a lot of people to upgrade their houses. People could buy homes with longer commutes, and some took advantage by moving to states with better living standards. Now, home sales and turnover have been slowing throughout the year as rates moved higher. Rising rates and home prices have pulled down affordability, and worry about inflation in the economy made people more cautious. However, most of that slowdown is a drop from the steamy levels during the pandemic. You know, say total home sales, existing plus new, is now around 15% below 2019 and close to the 2018 level. So the next slide shows that the Census's American Community Survey data suggests that housing turnover was about 7 CPR before the pandemic. So a 15% drop would put speeds around 6 CPR. Now, of course, seasonality will play a role, and so in the winter months, you know, maybe things go down closer to 5 CPR and can pick up to closer to 8 in the summer. The home sales data, also included on the chart, it points to somewhat slower turnover, but I think that estimate is probably biased low, you know, over those years due to the growth of single-family rentals. So I think a big question is how much an existing borrower's low-rate mortgage will lock them into their current home. And people would certainly be reluctant to walk away from an attractive mortgage. But a lot of the reasons that people move are going to happen regardless of mortgage rates. And how many people will turn down a good job because their mortgage rate will increase? Over time, it seems likely that these pressures will cause people to move regardless of what happens to their existing mortgage. The lock-in, therefore, seems more likely to be kind of a short to medium-term effect, but fading over longer horizons as turnover reverts to the mean. So another lift of turnover comes from home equity, and borrowers have a lot of equity right now. The home equity, it's a key ingredient to housing turnover. Borrowers have a levered investment in their homes, and many people rely on home equity gains to buy a larger home. A lot of borrowers should have enough equity growth to buy a larger home and possibly even make a larger down payment to help lower financing costs. So I think another way to look at that is to, and current borrower activity, is to look at the loans that are currently being originated and pooled. So I picked June 2022 as an example, just since most loans originated that in that month are likely to have been pooled by now. And, you know, the average purchase loan had about a 5 1/3% note rate, and there were an appreciable number of cash out refis, and still maybe around, say, 20% of production or so, with an average note rate of nearly 5.5%. So people are still taking out loans, even cash outs, after a lot of this year's big rate increase was already priced in. And the volume of loans in that month were actually surprisingly close to the volume that was done 3 years earlier in June 2019 when rates were much lower and there was a lot less lock-in. So that's not to say that turnover has not or should not slow, but some people have to move and that helps place a floor on speeds. And other people may only be able to tap home equity with a cash-out refi, even if it means paying off the low-rate mortgage. You know, the credit score of cash-out borrowers has fallen nearly 20 points since January, which suggests that HELOCs and second liens may not be readily available to borrowers with weak credit, and debt consolidation might just make the cash-out attractive, you know, regardless of giving up an existing low-rate mortgage. So I think the big risk of turnover would be if home equity goes away. The future path of home prices is important, and existing borrowers with a lot of equity can handle slower home price growth or even some depreciation. But newer borrowers and borrowers in geographic areas that had weaker home price growth over the last few years are more exposed to slower appreciation or outright depreciation. The next slide shows historical and projected home price appreciation. CoreLogic's historical HPA is to the left of the blue vertical line, and Moody's projections are to the right. And the dark blue solid line shows national HPA, which peaked around 20% annual growth, but is projected to fall close to 0% by the end of next year and stay there for a few years before slowly ramping up to a long-term average of about 4.5%. But a lot of the country does not track the national average. The chart also shows a dispersion of home price appreciation across various metropolitan areas. During the pandemic, some locations' home prices grew 30% or more, while others grew only 10%. And the forecast maintains some of that dispersion. And that suggests that about half the country could have falling home prices for a number of years. Now, mortgage investors don't want to be holding securities backed by the wrong 50%. And that depreciation should contribute to slower than average turnover and prepayment speeds in loans in those areas, while the other 50% would experience modest appreciation and should maintain overall faster than average turnover and prepayment speeds. And so the pockets of faster turnover should come from places with stronger past and projected housing markets. And seasoned borrowers with a lot of equity in the location where home prices do not fall should have faster turnover and prepayments than other places, where new originations are more likely to struggle since future home price growth is expected to be so modest. There should be a separation in speeds between, you know, for example, loans originated this year compared to those originated 2 years ago. Picking seasoning in the right geographies can lead to faster turnover and higher returns. And finally, another idea is just to look at seasoned loans with smaller loan sizes. Smaller loans usually turn over faster, likely because those borrowers are typically younger. So they tend to have growing families and incomes and need larger homes. And there's overall less lock-in since the existing loan is small. So higher rates might not affect speeds as much as they will for higher balance loans. And thank you. And for that, I'll hand it back to Steve.
All right. Thanks very much, Brian. I also want to highlight for the audience a piece that APS Portfolio Strategy published this summer by Brian Landy that was an extensive dive into the many factors, subtle and not so subtle, that are affecting some of the issues that he was just talking about. I forget whether it was 50 or 75 pages long, but it really is an encyclopedia on exactly these topics. So if you don't have it, I'd encourage you to get your hands on it. Okay, one other twist in the housing story has been the rental market, especially with affordability now obviously well beyond the reach of a growing set of U.S. households. And there's a big market in multifamily rentals and an evolving market in single-family rentals. And Mary Beth Fisher has a view of where those markets are going in the short and in the long run. Mary Beth.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. So I want to kind of leverage off of what Steve Stanley and Lori Goodman were talking about and use that base to look at what's really going to happen, what demographics and supply of rental housing, supply and demand is going to do for the rental housing market versus the homeowner-occupied market. So the first thing that is kind of a fundamental outlook is that the demand for rental housing in particular is projected to outpace the demand for owner-occupied housing over the next two decades. This is predominantly due to the geographic shifts that both Stephen Stanley and Lori Goodman were talking about. And the reason this is going to happen is based on projections that, first of all, the population of renters is, it overlaps a little bit with the population of homeowners, but it tends to be quite distinct. The population of renters tends to be younger. They tend to be lower income. They tend to have had reached a lower education level, in part because they tend to be younger. And they are renters tend to be predominantly much more ethnically diverse as a population than the population of homeowners. Even though population growth is expected to slow over the next few decades, the majority of the new household formation is actually projected to come from this demographic of renters, not necessarily the demographic that works for homeowners. Put all that together, and what we're looking at is homeownership rates, which have actually increased a little bit to just about 66% right now. So you have 66% homeowners, 34% renters. That's over the next two decades to decline, so that the homeownership rate roughly is projected to fall to 60%, and tenant rate is expected to rise from 34% to 40%. So when you look at that together, the growth of rental properties, of new household formation for renters, and the need for that supply is going to grow much faster, actually, than the need for the increase in supply of single-family homes. So what's going on with supply? The supply of rental housing, as Lori was fantastic at pointing out, is really influenced by the channels that you get for financing it. And who supplies rental housing financing? This is really dominated by the GSEs right now and commercial banks. Between the two of them, they're responsible for over 80% of financing for multifamily properties, for rental properties overall. That's not a bad thing, but you're looking at these two sectors, the GSEs and commercial banks, are both subject to very heavy regulatory burden that actually increased after the financial crisis. So they're subject to risk limits. They're subject to capital constraints. This has really tightened the credit box that these organizations can lend to. And as Lori pointed out, tight lending standards tend to be detrimental to smaller builders, smaller owners, smaller landlords. The GSEs and banks both like professional landlords. They like people to like their landlords and their borrowers to own a portfolio of properties, not a small handful of properties or single properties. All of this kind of starts to favor institutional operators. And institutional operators are not typically in the very low very low and moderate income affordable housing sectors. So those are the primary channels for financing in the rental population. Now, what is coming up are institutional operators for single-family renters. They are still a very small sliver of the population, but they're important because they can tap the securitization markets directly outside of the GSEs, outside of the commercial banks, and they can tap private equity financing. So that gives, again, they have a supply of financing that they can access that is outside of those really heavy capital-constrained, risk limit-constrained channels. So they can operate in a slightly larger box. Now, the chronic undersupply, when you think about the supply of financing influencing the supply of rental housing, is still subject to, as Lori pointed out, much bigger hurdles, which are regulatory hurdles, municipal zoning hurdles, NIMBYism in neighborhoods. You have a really unfortunate circumstance that local community boards, local neighborhood groups have continued to torpedo projects in their neighborhoods and cities across the country. And ironically, this has been the most prevalent in areas that need that low-income housing and affordable housing desperately. So there's, as Lori said, and that's, I'm sure that's why she made some of the suggestions, is you need to find a different way to attack that problem, because getting through those state and municipal zoning boards, getting through kind of the neighborhood groups is going to be difficult. You need to have some sort of federal options. And then you need to allow people to build accessory dwelling units in their backyard. Going back to what Steve Stanley was talking about, when you look at rental housing, the affordability issues, hopefully in the short run, are really intense. But in the long run, you know, after about, you know, a few years of flat home price appreciation, potentially interest rates eventually coming back down, those affordability issues should reverse. What that's going to do right now, though, and what it's going to do for the next few years, is it increases the demand for multifamily housing and increases the demand for single-family rentals, because single-family rentals exist in basically a crossover space where you've been, you tend to be, single-family renters tend to have higher income than all-over tenants, and they tend to they most often come from the population of people that have been just barely priced out of being homeowners. So if affordability starts to favor owning homes again, then you'll see more people moving out of single-family rentals into being homeowners, but that's going to be probably a few years down the road. If you want to think about how that's been impacted by mortgage rates, I'm going to make the math a little bit easier. The median household, let's pretend the median household has an income of about $100,000. It's a little bit less than that, but again, just to make the math easier. At a 3% mortgage rate, they can, if they can afford a $1,200 a month payment, they can afford a house that's $350,000. That's 3.5 times their total household income at $100,000 at a 3% rate. At a 6% rate, to keep the same payment, they can only afford a house that's $250,000. That's about the ground we've traversed in the last 6 months. We've gone from, on average, a 3% rate at the beginning of the year to about a 6% rate now. Think of that as a median household has gone from being able to afford a $350,000 house to a $250,000 house. When Steve Stanley was talking about that's what's caused that sharp drop in affordability, that's what you're looking at. So you either need, as Brian Landy said, you either need home prices to basically stay flat for several years so incomes can catch up, or you need, and actually better, and you need mortgage rates to eventually come down when the Fed finishes its tightening cycle, everything gets a little bit better, and or we go into a recession and they have to start easing rates. So you need the combination of those two things. Over the next two decades, and certainly over the next decade, the investment implications of this is really quite clear, that the best thing to do is stay overweight multifamily housing because you still have a chronic undersupply, and stay overweight single-family rentals, which is probably one of the strongest sectors. If you missed the article in the Wall Street Journal, they talked about builders now selling as many houses as they can to institutional operators for single-family rentals. Institutional operators are currently acting as a backstop bid for new home construction that single-family homeowners can't afford suddenly because of the drop in affordability. This is actually great for both populations because you have an investor who's willing to absorb that supply. It buffers the downside for home prices, and it also increases the supply for renters. So it sort of takes a little bit of the pressure off of the multifamily rental supply. Where you can find the most multifamily housing for investment, obviously in agency CMBS. CRE CLOs are also a great sector. 65% of the collateral in CRE CLOs is actually multifamily collateral. It's in transition. A lot of that collateral is also in the affordable housing sector. So the most undersupplied area in the multifamily space is actually in CRE CLO collateral. Great place to be, really puts a good back bid, a good outlook on that kind of sector for that collateral. And obviously single family rentals, whether you do it in the securitization market or whether you do it through private deals, private financing, single family rentals is also an excellent sector to be in. And I'm going to wrap it up right there.
All right. Thanks very much, Mary Beth. I just want to remind everybody to please use that chat feature to ask questions. It's been open all the way through, but remains open. So please take advantage of that. Finally, housing hits investment grade corporate debt, obviously, but in particular, it hits most directly through home builders. And even if you're not a corporate investor, the home builders open a window on what housing looks like on the ground. So our corporate analyst on that sector, Dan Brizzo, has been watching the home builders and has these notes from the front line. Dan, it's all yours.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm definitely going to keep it very brief here. This is the last piece, so you made it this far. For those of you I haven't met before, I am one of the investment grade corporate debt strategists here at Amherst. I mostly cover the financial sector, which includes banks, insurance, REITs, money managers, as well as some areas within industrial, which includes the home builders. The builders are a relatively smaller niche within the broader corporate market. There's only several IG issuers and a fairly limited amount of public debt outstanding. Nevertheless, as Steve said, we do believe these credits provide the best lens through which to view the housing sector and corporate IG and do serve as bellwethers to make broader investment decisions with regard to the direction of housing. On the next slide here, we have two looks at how home builders help gauge the broader housing segment. The first demonstrates the National Association of Home Builders Market Index, which takes a monthly poll of how national home builders view operating conditions. As you can see on the graph, that sentiment tends to move in opposite direction of mortgage rates. Not really a surprise there. And more recently, we saw the gauge pass below the 50 threshold, which indicates that more builders now view conditions as poor as opposed to good. This is relevant because this is the first time we crossed this line since the 2013 taper tantrum. On the second graphic, we see how home builder corporate bond spreads depict conditions in the market viewed against new U.S. home sales. Credit spreads tend to widen as sales drop and vice versa. Likewise, we're seeing bond spreads widen more recently as home sales have hit their lowest nominal level since the middle of last decade, 2016. Now, as operating conditions worsen, we turn focus to the individual credit profiles of the home builders themselves to get some perspective on how the companies have improved since the height and immediate fallout of the great financial crisis. So here on the next slide, we see the six largest investment grade home builders leverage depicted in two ways. On one graphic, it's shown as total debt to EBITDA, and on the other graphic, it's shown as total debt to equity. Now, in either case, we're seeing much improved leverage since the peaks of 2010 and 2011. not only as a function of the improved cash flows in the case of EBITDA, but also due to a conscious effort by these operators to delever their balance sheets more conservatively and then actively manage to investment grade ratings requirements. We've had a lot of home builders fall out of the IG space since then, and this, you know, the survivorship bias has created better credits. Okay, the stronger credit profiles provide them with the flexibility to weather weaker operating conditions as new home sales decline and cash flows moderate. On the next slide, we demonstrate the six largest companies' new homes contracted and new homes delivered over the past two decades. While growth is clearly moderating and some instances actually declining in recent quarters, it's definitely worth noting that we are coming off historical peaks that were aided by not only the global pandemic as well as historically low rates, but also the rising migration patterns from urban centers to suburban areas that some of the other speakers addressed. Over the last two quarters, these issuers have been revising down guidance as demand is softening amid spiking mortgage rates. Not surprisingly, we are seeing cancellation rates on the rise, but in most cases, it would appear that we are, with regard to cancellation rates, that we're moving back to more typical run rates than we have over the past 2 years. So we're moving to a more normalized level. While expectations for both contracted sales and closings are mostly lower from the companies themselves, we are seeing overall production move back again into more historically typical ranges. And that's not to say that more declines are not likely in the near term, but the IG builders have generally managed down their inventories more diligently and therefore a better position to avoid materially boosting incentives to work through existing inventory than they had been historically. Now, on the last slide, we show the historical track for cash bond spreads of the individual issuers of the past 2 years. Again, outstanding paper for home builders is very limited. In fact, there's only 27 U.S. dollar index eligible bonds outstanding among the big six issuers in the investment grade space. So not a lot of bonds to read from. But we can clearly see the widening trend year to date among some of the more liquid issues that are outstanding in the intermediate space. While I think spreads are likely to drift a little wider with the broader credit market and perhaps to a greater order magnitude than the broad market in the near term, I do think relative value in the sector is becoming increasingly compelling. Absolute yields are falling in the range of 6 to 7% for intermediate paper with 7 to 10 year maturities. That's viewed very favorably against the broader market. For example, Pulte Homes, PHM, which moved back into the IG market over the past 2 years after spending some time in high yield, offers some of the more liquid issues in the 10 to 12 year space, and total yields there north of 7%. So among those are the PHM 7 7/8 of 32, 10, on the run 10 year bond, which are currently indicated in the range of 330 to 325 to the 10-year in that context, or a total yield of roughly 7.1%. Also, while it's classified as more of a crossover credit due to split ratings, I do like the Toll Brothers name due to its positioning as a luxury operator. While there's been an evident decline in demand at Toll with the broader market, the luxury niche definitely sees a higher amount of new home sales financed in cash and is therefore less sensitive to mortgage rates than typical operators. So again, Toll 5-year notes are indicated in roughly the 285 to 275 spread context to the 5-year, which is a total yield of right around 680, which is extremely compelling for this part of the curve in the investment grade space. As I said, I keep it brief. That's it for me. I appreciate your attention, and I'm going to pass the floor back over to Steve. Thank you.
All right, Dan. Thanks very much. So we have been getting questions all the way through. Much appreciated. I can answer one or actually multiple that are touched on the same topic. We will be posting these slides along with a recording of this call tomorrow morning. Look for an email from us, and after that email, they will be on the APS Portfolio Strategy website in perpetuity, so you can always go back and listen to one of your favorites. There have been a number of questions, many of them related to pricing in particular. Why would home prices run flat over the next couple of years, and what particular factors might make home prices go negative in specific markets, and that sounds like one for Brian Landy.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think for flat home prices, some of it was touched on earlier, you do have tight housing supply, but I think with the drop in affordability of lowering demand, but I think you kind of put all that together and it's the tight supply will just keep, in a lot of places, the housing market tight enough that home prices are unlikely to fall. You do also have a factor that, you know, some people will be able, who do decide if they don't want to sell into a soft market, could defer a sale and just not proceed with it. And so some of the slowing turnover kind of goes hand in hand with like bolstering or preventing home prices from falling, right? So there's a certain stickiness to home prices to the downside. Now, you know, where could you have some actual declines? But I think that's where you have weaker markets where there's just lower overall demand. And so we certainly, over the last couple of years, saw places that, you know, home prices only went up 10% as opposed to 30%. And so I think markets like that where there's just overall aggregate less demand, people are moving out of those locations and moving into other locations. So we have those net out migrations. Those are more likely the places where there just won't be enough activity to support home prices. You might see some declines.
Okay, fabulous. Also a question related, arguably, on rental growth. So, Mary Beth, what's your thoughts there?
Rental growth really does track home prices, obviously, because you have a choice with the affordability constraints. And even if it's like, even if the market itself isn't having affordable constraints, you always have the choice of renting or owning. So broadly speaking, rental growth trends tend to track home price growth trends. Single family rental growth trends really closely track home price growth trends, though they tend to lag them. So we're expecting to see single family rent growth continuing to rise. It's slowed down a lot, but it's continuing to rise, probably going to stay positive a little bit longer than home price growth is going to stay positive. So by next year, you'll probably see single family rent growth, which has already topped out, start to fall back down towards 3%, probably stay down at 3%, 3 to 4%. But the increasing population of tenants within 5 years will probably actually raise the price of multifamily rent growth back towards 5 or 6% as a standard instead of being kind of the long-term average of 3% as a standard. And again, like as Brian said, when you look at very specific markets, you have to look at what's going on in that market. What's going to happen in New York is really going to depend on how much supply they can get in new multifamily buildings. That's going to be dependent in all of the big metro areas, which are much more constrained than less dense areas of the country. So micro markets have their own issues, but broadly speaking, rent growth with a bigger move into tenants should really kind of outpace home price growth on average within 5 to 10 years.
Okay, Mary Beth, thanks so much. We have a long list of questions there. I wish we could continue, but I want to respect everyone's time. So we are out of it, at least for now. I want to thank our speakers, Stephen Stanley, Laurie Goodman, Brian Landy, Mary Beth Fisher, and Dan Brizzo. As I mentioned, slides and a replay will be posted tomorrow. Also, if you want another chance to break the Internet, we're having another call next week. This is going to be on October 12th. We're going to launch a series, Masters in Credit, where I will sit down with Joe Maroney. He's a partner and co-head of Global Corporate Credit at Apollo Global Management. He has 28 years plus in the business managing CLOs and oversees Redding Ridge, which is Apollo's platform for managing nearly $20 billion in CLOs. So please look for an announcement of that call. Again, thanks to our listeners for dialing in. This has been an APS Portfolio Strategy conference call, Housing, Present, Future, and its Impact on Markets. Have a good day.